back to the program as we turn our attention right now to the crisis in Darfur. It has become one of the most notable causes of our time. While we talk about it in terms of the genocide, the death of 400,000 people, and the impact and relationship to the war on terror, the reality of Darfur in the Sudan may in fact be entirely different. What if everything we think we know about Darfur is either wrong or misjudged? This is the topic of our program this morning, as we are joined by my guest Mahmoud Mamdani. He's the Herbert Lehman Professor of Government and a member of the Departments of Anthropology and Political Science at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. He's the author of the previous best-selling Good Muslim, Bad Muslim. His newest book is Saviors and Survivors, Darfur, Politics, and the War on Terror. Mahmoud Mamdani, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Delight to have you here. Why is it that this issue has become, this issue of what's taking place in Africa, has become almost a domestic political issue here in the United States?
I think the answer lies in precisely what you said, which is that unlike any other African tragedy, the deaths in Congo, which are many more than in Darfur, the AIDS pandemic, Darfur is the focus of a domestic political movement in the U.S., and this is not just any ordinary movement. It's the most successful mobilization since the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War period, except that unlike the Vietnam War, the anti-war movement of that period, this is not a peace movement. This is a mobilization for war. If you look at its slogans, boots on the ground, out of Iraq, into Darfur, demands for no-fly zones. This is not a movement which wants a political settlement in Darfur. This is a movement which wants an external military intervention.
How did it get to this point, in your view?
I think that basically, you know, this has been a puzzle for me, and I'll tell you why. In 2006, a U.S. agency called the Government Accountability Office looked at six different estimates of how many people had died in Darfur. The lowest estimate was from the World Health Organization, about 70,000 people, and the highest was from Save Darfur, about 400,000. The GAO got together with the U.S. Academy of Sciences, put together a panel of 12 experts, asked them to look at these studies and pronounce on their reliability. The experts, without exception, said that the high-level estimates were unreliable. They were based on extrapolation from a small number of studies, and the most reliable estimates were the lowest level. The other thing that the World Health Organization study brought out was that of the 70,000 dead, 70 to 80% had died from effects of drought and desertification, mainly diarrhea and dysentery, and the main victims being infants and children. 20 to 30% had died from direct effects of violence. Now, that was 2006. In spite of this report, which the State Department concurred with, in spite of this report, Save Darfur continued with its publicity of 400,000 plus dead. The facts seem to have absolutely no impact either on the publicity of the organization or on its remarkable success in mobilization. So this was the puzzle that I confronted. I could understand the tendency of those who think that they possess overwhelming power to ignore facts of reality until they are checked by these facts. But what I couldn't understand was why the mobilization was so successful, especially because this was the time the war in Iraq was raging, and I could see that there was hardly any mobilization around Iraq, but a huge mobilization, especially in universities and schools around Darfur. My friends would tell me that that's because there is no draft, but I said there's no draft around Darfur. And ultimately, you know, I realized I made sense of it by recalling that when I came to the U.S. as a graduate student, as a student in the 60s, I remember being so struck by the fact that Americans were so generous when it came to giving to charities and so stingy when it came to paying taxes. And I realized that when Americans relate to Iraq, they relate to Iraq as citizens. Iraq makes some people feel guilty. It makes other people feel the limits on American power. But when they relate to Darfur, they don't relate to Darfur as citizens. They relate to Darfur as humans, as a charity, as some kind of a philanthropic gesture. So Iraq is more like a tax. Darfur is philanthropy. Darfur is a place to feel good. It's about feel-good politics in American society. And it is interesting that the Save Darfur movement, if you go to its website, it's just a cataloging of atrocities. It never tells you why this conflict has happened. When did it begin? What were the fluctuations in mortality rates? It never tells you that starting January 2005, the level of mortality has dropped so much so that the average number of civilian deaths were less than 200 a month from January 2005. There has been no emergency since then. An emergency is being created now through a war-type mobilization. So this is how I made sense of the puzzle.
Why has the reporting from the region, and certainly there's been more coverage of Darfur than virtually anything else going on the African continent, the reporting has been so consistent with the stories coming from Save Darfur, whether it's Nicholas Kristof at the New York Times or just the other general reporting that we've seen over several years?
Whether it's Kristof or whether it's Eric Reeves, the reporting has not been based on reporters being sent to Darfur. The only reporter I know who has reported consistently from Darfur is the London Independent reporter, and who has been saying ad infinitum that there has been no emergency since January 2005. She wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, but still she was a very lonely voice out there. By and large, the media has simply registered the tremendous domestic political force of the Save Darfur movement, as has Congress. The State Department, interestingly enough, has resisted it. Colin Powell was in Darfur the day before Bush announced that there was a genocide going on. And when he left from Khartoum Airport, he was asked by NPR and other media about whether there was a genocide unfolding in Darfur, and he kept on saying, no, my lawyers have told me no, all the evidence we have before us is no. When Robert Zoellick went to Sudan, and he was asked about the numbers dead, the figure he gave was less than 100,000, and the Washington Post did an editorial extremely upset, asking him to cite better figures next time. Not more accurate figures, but better figures next time. When Bush's special envoy to Sudan, Andrew Natsios, gave his testimony to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he made it very clear to the committee that, look, the government of Sudan had simply lost control in Darfur, that the atrocities going on, the rape, for example, seemed to be widespread wherever young armed men confronted unarmed women. And so it was as much in evidence in camps controlled by rebels as it was in evidence in camps controlled by soldiers. So we have this intermittent reporting, but by and large, the media has been content to report what the Save Darfur movement has been saying.
What about the international community's attitude towards President Bashir and the attitude about his crimes against humanity?
I think the international community has responded from multiple motives. Number of them have simply been worried about their own skins and have simply had this kind of a trade union response, which is uninterested in what has been going on in Darfur, but simply interested in the fact that those in power goes with impunity. That's been their response. That's one kind of response. There's another kind of response, which I think has been strongest in the African Union. And in the African Union, it has been a response conditioned much more by the African experience with bringing conflicts to an end, starting with the end of apartheid in South Africa, then going on to Mozambique, then going on to South Sudan. In all of these instances, Africans have learned that you don't prioritize criminal justice, you prioritize political reform. for the simple reason that if you prioritize criminal justice, you will end up taking to court precisely the very people who are in power, who you need to engineer political reform. And so the cost of it will be no political reform and a continuing conflict and more people dead and injured. So they have learned, begin with political reform. That will bring the conflict to an end and then move to a rule of law and criminal justice. So the Africans basically have a disagreement on how to bring conflicts like this to an end.
What does the Save Darfur movement seek now, in your view?
Well, I think the Save Darfur movement, it has been totally, not simply reluctant, it has been unwilling to recognize that there has been no emergency in Darfur since January 2005. It has also been unwilling to recognize that this fact presents an opportunity for a political solution. It has been pushing for a military solution, starting with a no-fly zone. This has encouraged those on both sides, on the government side, those who don't want a reform and who say that any concession is simply a first step to regime change. And on the rebel side, those who think that any agreement will be at the expense of victory. They're simply expecting to wait it out and foreign forces to go in and power to fall in their lap. So unfortunately, we're strengthening the hardline elements on both sides.
Take us back to 1987, 1989, and the beginnings of the conflict that would lead to where we are today in Darfur.
Look, the first important thing to realize is this conflict began before the government in Sudan, the present government, came to power. The Islamists came to power in 89. The conflict began in 87, 89. There were multiple causes for the conflict. The deep cause was the way the British had divided up land in Darfur. They had taken all land and divided it up between tribes, giving more land to settled tribes, peasants who just settled on a fixed piece of land, a little less land to cattle nomads who have villages but move around half the year, and no tribal land to camel nomads who have no villages and they move all around the year. With this background, then comes the drought and desertification. The Sahara expands 100 kilometers in 40 years. The crisis reaches its zenith mid-1980s. The expansion of the Sahara pushes the camel nomads of the north down south. They head down south to the lush mountain land in central Darfur, the Jabal Murrah, which is about 70 kilometers of a mountain range, green, and begins a classic ecological war. The third factor which contributes to this is that whereas usually the war would have been with traditional weapons, Darfur becomes victim of the civil war in Chad and the fact that it is being armed through a Cold War confrontation. Reagan, France, Israel are arming one side. Gaddafi and the Soviet Union are arming another side. Whoever is in power is in the capital city. The opposition runs to Darfur, where they train, mobilize, arm, and from there they attack. Darfur has no water in the mid-80s, but it's awash with guns. So the scale of destruction is horrendous. But also the level of violence is something nobody's experienced before. A Darfuri anthropologist, Sharif Hariri, writing about that period at that time, commented that the only thing that made sense to him as to why such brutality was rampant was that life itself was at stake. This conflict was about land. It was between landless tribes and tribes with land. And whoever would get land would survive. Whoever didn't get land wouldn't have a way of surviving, of making ends meet. So it was either you live or I live. That kind of zero-sum game.
And of course, all of this gave rise to the internal insurgency, which begat a kind of counterinsurgency, all of which was responsible for upping the level of violence.
The internal insurgency begins in 2003, in the third phase of the violence. And now this is the period, 2003-2004, is a period in which the Bashir government in Khartoum unleashes its own little war on terror in Darfur. It unleashes a horrendous violence as counterinsurgency, targeting not only rebels with guns, but civilians who may be identified with those rebels. In my view, it basically follows the international sort of environment after 9/11, follows the example of the Bush administration in terms of a war on terror, where good violence confronts bad violence, and where there are no limits on good violence, because bad violence represents evil, and evil must be eradicated. There is no coexisting with evil. There are no political solutions. It's just a confrontation between good and evil. And that's how the Islamists of Khartoum understood it, exactly as the fellows in the White House understood it. Now, that is a period of terrible injustice, 2003-2004, and for that there will have to be some kind of justice, but in time, when that justice will not, when that the pursuit of justice will not simply propel the conflict, but has to come after the conflict is ended.
Talk about the Arab tribes in the Sudan.
You know, this was the hardest nut for me to crack, because there's a history of Sudan written. It is written mainly by the British, and then it was embraced by the nationalists. And this history basically talks of Sudan being civilized through successive migrations. Initially pharaonic migration, then a Byzantine Christian, then Arab Muslim, and then British Western. And I wondered that this land, Nubia, northern Sudan, a land with 6,000 years of recorded history, how could that history simply be explained on the basis of external migrations? And I began to look for alternative accounts. And as I read other histories starting in the 1960s, I realized that actually the migration account and the idea that there was one group called Arabs was questioned through a whole series of smaller studies, which pointed out that actually people became Arabs at different periods of time. That in the 15th, 16th, 17th century, the royalty, not only in Sudan, but all the way from Ethiopia right up to Senegal, the royalty everywhere claimed to be descendants of the Holy Land. So the Ethiopian king claimed kinship with King Solomon, and the Sultan of Fanj in northern Sudan claimed to be descended from the house of the Prophet of Islam. Then other studies pointed out that 100 years later, when commercial civilization developed in the Kingdom of Fanj, and number of towns increased from about 2 in 1700 to about 25 to 30 at the end of 1700, new kinds of conflict emerged. These were basically conflicts based arising from the marketplace. And a tension arose between merchants on the one hand and the royal house on the other hand as to which rules would be used to solve these conflicts. The royal house said custom, merchants said Sharia. Sharia, Islamic law, having come out of the Byzantine period, was particularly commerce-friendly. The merchants won out, and at the end of it, they said, we are Arabs. And the middle classes became Arabs. In the nationalist period, this Arabness spread amongst the popular classes. My point is simply that what became clear is that there is no single history of Arabs in Sudan. There are many histories of Arabs. Now, the big distinction is between the Arabs of the Nile, who identify with power and are mostly privileged, and the Arabs of Darfur, who are the worst off people in Darfur. If you take any statistics, income, level of education, employment, professionals in the society, the Arabs come at the bottom. If Darfur is marginalized in Sudan, the Arabs of Darfur are doubly marginalized. This is the poorest of the poor in Sudan. So, and the idea that they came from anywhere is absurd, because this is part of the nomadic population which for millennia has been going around the rim of the Sahara, basically, between the southern rim of the Sahara and the rain belt in the equator, where the tsetse fly stops it from going because camels will not be able to stand it. And this has been their home since recorded history tells us.
And finally, to what extent is the misconception and the degree to which Save Darfur has been so effective, to what extent is that standing in the way of the political reforms, the land reforms that need to take place to bring an end to the violence?
I think it's a major obstacle today. It's a major obstacle because the Save Darfur story has a monopoly in the media. And because people have basically bought it, because the media has allowed for no debate whatsoever. So that if you look at the new administration, if you look at the vice president, the secretary of state, the ambassador at the UN, all of these people have bought the Save Darfur story. Hopefully the State Department will give counter-information, because it's the only agency in government with some counter-information. Hopefully it will, and hopefully there will be more of a debate possible in the media so that counter voices are heard.
Mahmoud Mamdani, the book is Saviors and Survivors, Darfur Politics and the War on Terror. It's just out from Pantheon. Mahmoud, I thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jeff.